Today on the 21st Show, major changes are happening in the world of public health. They're being driven by the preferences of RFK Jr., the second Trump administration, and their allies in the Republican Party. And they're going to affect people both here in the U.S. and around the world. Today, we have two perspectives on that. Regina Rabinovich previously served as head of infectious diseases for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And Jennifer Nuzzo is director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health. We also want to hear how you're thinking about public health, disease, and vaccines. You can join us throughout the hour today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Public health in America is undergoing dramatic changes. The federal government is limiting access to some vaccines and defunding research into the treatment and prevention of certain diseases. This is mostly the work of the second Trump administration under the leadership of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And I said American public health, but it's having global effects, too. Take malaria, for example, a disease that spreads to humans mainly from mosquitoes. Every year, more than 500,000 people die from malaria. The largest share of them are in Africa. In recent years, the U.S. has played a major role in fighting the disease in the form of more than $1 billion annually. That is, until this year, when the Trump administration froze foreign aid. Someone who's been deeply involved in the work of fighting malaria is Regina Rabinovich of Carbondale, Illinois. She previously served as the head of infectious diseases for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, one of the biggest charitable foundations in the world. Regina is a scholar at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She also has a position at the Institute for Public Health at the University of Barcelona in Spain. She came to our attention through an article in the journal Science called Losing Protection, and we'll have a link to that at our website, 21stshow.org. Originally, our plan was just to talk with Rabinovich about malaria in the wake of that Science article. But with everything that's been happening and considering her knowledge in this field, we wanted to expand the conversation to talk more broadly as well about what's happening in public health today. We'll be doing that a little later in the program. We'll have another nationally renowned health expert with us for that as well. For now, Dr. Rabinovich, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, you can join the conversation today at 800-222-9455. What questions do you have about malaria in particular or other diseases and vaccines in general? What do you think of the federal government's pullback of funding for foreign aid, the USAID, for example? And how do you think that will affect the world and America's place in it? Again, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. All right, let's just talk a little bit about malaria for people who may not be familiar. What are some of the symptoms of malaria? What is it like to actually get this disease?
It actually feels a lot like a bad case of flu. And when I got malaria coming back from the Gambia, I had to figure out, did I have flu because it was fall, or did I have malaria? And the good news is there's a diagnostic. I had fever, shaking chills, headache. I was sore all over, and very rapidly they were able to diagnose that, actually very easily, unfortunately, that I had malaria. I was like a child in Africa. I was immune naive. I'd never had it before, so it was more severe than it would be for an adult in Africa.
You know, the United States only sees a few thousand cases of this a year, usually from people who do travel internationally. Why don't we see that afflicting more people here in the U.S.?
We had very aggressive campaigns in the late 50s, 60s that basically got rid of the parasite. The parasite, it's not the mosquito that gives it to you. The mosquito transfers the parasite to you from another person. So it is a disease in which you have to manage the mosquito. You have to figure out how to kill the parasite. That's with treatment in humans. And you have to treat the symptoms in children, and particularly the most fragile children and pregnant moms. And so there were very effective campaigns in the United States with spraying, with treatment, the older drugs, and with finding the cases as they appeared. Foggy Bottom in Washington, D.C., was a hotbed of malaria and yellow fever, and it's gone. The cases we see are by far brought in by people who've been on vacation, traveling, or coming in from an area where they've gotten infected, as was I when I got my case.
I understand the CDC is one of the reasons it's even in Atlanta has to do with the fact that malaria was prevalent in the South during World War II.
They wanted, the story I've been told is that they wanted CDC to have a focus on malaria and other infectious diseases, and they wanted them to be someplace else other than DC. They've been very successful at implementing their programs from Atlanta. Yes.
So what does it take to fight malaria at the individual level, right? You mentioned some of the
Right.
systematic things, yeah.
Yeah, well, at the individual level, you have to protect yourself. So prevention, right? That means generally sleeping under a bed net because mosquitoes bite in the early evening and into the night. It means community interventions like treating infected bodies of water where the larvae sit. And it means having a health system that can respond to a febrile child, to a baby or a child that has a fever, and you're trying to figure out what it is with something called a rapid diagnostic test, which can be done at bedside, can be done by a lay health worker, does not need to be done at a hospital, but needs to be done rapidly. So that requires an effective healthcare system. And in Africa, quite often that is part of the essential system is community health workers who are trained to manage diseases which need a rapid response, like malaria.
How did the United States end up playing such an important role in fighting malaria in other countries?
I think the United States became aware of the reality, which was at the time that investments began in the early 2000s, 2005, 2006, and when the President's Malaria Initiative was established, malaria had, for the past decade, the rates had gone up to, well, who knows how many cases, because there wasn't very good surveillance or ways of estimating it. But the estimate of deaths was over a million children a year, mostly in Africa. Also in Asia, but mostly in Africa. So, it had been abandoned as a global health priority when an attempt at eradication was made in the 50s. And when that worked in some places, that the United States responded very well, a lot of Europe responded very well. And got rid of malaria, it was really never tackled in Africa. And for that past decade, even though we had insecticides and we had ways of treating and new ways that were coming on board, they were not being used. And I think congressional staff and leaders in Congress became concerned that this was something in which they could have impact. And thus was born, a couple of years later, the President's Malaria Initiative with bipartisan support.
And I mentioned that you were previously affiliated with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Talk about the role that charity and private philanthropy has played in helping to respond to this.
I think that's exactly the right phrase, helping to respond, because there is no charity in the world that is big enough to take on national responsibilities. Anyone that's looked at the right map of where the United States would fit in one corner of Africa. Africa's huge, it's many countries, many different cultures, many different governments, and the needs are huge. The impact of a disease like malaria is also huge. And the countries vary in how much spending they make on their infectious diseases, including malaria. But it is quite often affecting countries with, for example, Mozambique is more than 60% of the population in 2025 that is in extreme poverty. So they don't have the resiliency and the robustness of resources that have been targeted on a disease like malaria.
So,
And this has caused this is really something that needs to continue to change.
well, okay. So let's talk about what has changed this year, although not for the better in terms of fighting malaria. What did the United States, how did its role in the fight against malaria change this year?
Well, 2 points. One will be about the United States and then how this reflects sort of bigger changes in development assistance, which is what's called when rich countries provide funding for poorer countries through a variety of mechanisms. What happened was that pretty rapidly there were decisions made to cut funding to USAID programs, but specifically for malaria and others like HIV, TB. Both three very important infectious diseases affecting populations worldwide.
I mean, you say decisions
And
made, but really we're
yes.
talking about Elon Musk feeding it into the wood chipper was the phrase I think he used
Well,
on
he
his.
did say that. It's
Yes.
quotable. But I think it was done very rapidly without a great understanding of what the impact would be, what the impact had been, what the return on investment of the US dollar had been for the various diseases, and focusing on expenditure but not impact and gains from it. So it was, and I don't think it was only affected, directed at malaria. He continued and had, really was attempting to shrink government in many different directions. But this
Well,
one
just about
was.
anything USAID was doing seemed to be
All right.
in that
Well, yes,
yeah.
and particularly nutrition, surveillance, so you knew what your impact would be, treatment and prevention of diseases that have the potential to kill millions. Malaria is easy to talk about because we have about 230 million cases a year and about 500,000 deaths. You were right on that. But it is an estimate, right, of what's going on. And yet we know it had improved dramatically since the advent of PMI and the Global Fund, another big bilateral funding mechanism for HIV, TB, and malaria. So there had been impact. And what we are watching for now is how, well, it's very unclear still. There's a lot of uncertainty. They will apparently put some of the malaria programs into the State Department as USAID has been zeroed out and moved into the State Department. But the State Department will have to grow the mechanisms to implement funding and initiate grants and manage that is not something that the State Department has done in the past, as far as I know. So there is a lot of uncertainty, and the groups that were being funded to implement these programs immediately had to, because they received cease work orders, immediately had to get rid of a significant number of staff. And these aren't just staff that were doing paperwork. These are people who had committed their careers and with joy at watching the impact that these programs were having on behalf of the US. So it was very painful to staff, and it's been, I think, extremely painful at the countries. They had very little time to prepare. And anyone who's sought funding from either alternative sources or Minister of Finance in your own country, those things take time. They're not immediate. And there's no single or multiple sources that can rescue this in totality. So right now, the countries are struggling with horrible decisions. Do you pay for diagnostics? Do you pay for treatment? Where do you target? Because you can't cover everyone. And the projections are that about 100,000 children will die because of those changes.
100,000 children will die because of those changes, you say. We have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but what do you understand about, I mean, everyday people, how they're responding to this, to the extent we know.
Well, I mean, I have a friend who just visited a clinic in the Democratic Republic of Congo, very successful, very well run by a faith-based organization, 450 children under treatment for HIV. They went home. They didn't come back. And many of the programs have drugs for a month or 2 months, and then there is no medication. That's it. So, those that were directly affected became very aware of it. The national leaders were in tears. I've witnessed this because they were watching a reversion of progress and projections of reversion of progress that had been so impressive with funding from the US and Japan and Norway and France and other countries, the UK. That had been part of this mobilization of resources and targeting these infectious diseases for the past 20 years.
We're going to have to take a break on the program. Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. We're speaking with Regina Rabinovich, who is a former head of infectious diseases at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, among other affiliations. She's currently a scholar at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and also has a position with the Institute for Public Health at the University of Barcelona in Spain. We're going to be broadening the conversation as we continue the program today to talk about not just the global consequences, but some of the consequences right here in America to what RFK Jr. is doing with his big changes in public health in America. We're going to be joined after the break by Jennifer Nuzzo, who's a professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at the Brown University School of Public Health. If you want to join us today, if you have questions or comments, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Please stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're talking for the hour about changes to public health in the United States, the effects here, and the effects that's having around the world. It's led to a lot of tension, as evidenced by an exchange at last week's Senate Finance Committee meeting between Democratic U.S. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon and Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr.
I hope that you will tell the American people how many preventable child deaths are an acceptable sacrifice for enacting an agenda that I think is fundamentally cruel and defies common sense. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do I get a reply? Senator, you've sat in that chair for how long? 20, 25 years, while the chronic disease in our children went up to 76%, and you said nothing. You never ask the question why it's happening. Why is this happening? Today, for the first time in 20 years, we learned that infant mortality has increased in our country. It's not because I came in here. It's because of what happened during the Biden administration that we're going to end.
Okay, we're going to get into that more on that in a few moments. We've been talking with one of our fellow Illinoisans, a Carbondale resident who has played a significant role in the international fight against malaria. Regina Rabinovich is former head of infectious diseases for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She's currently a scholar in residence at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. At this point, I'd also like to bring into the conversation another guest. Jennifer Nuzzo is a professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health. And in July, she was appointed to serve on the advisory committee to the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Jennifer Nuzzo, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. All right. Jennifer Nuzzo, I want to start this part of the conversation with news that Florida has announced plans to get rid of childhood vaccine mandates. The state surgeon general there, Dr. Joseph Ladapo, said, quote, people have a right to make their own decisions, informed decisions. They don't have the right to tell you what to put in your body, end quote. How would you respond to that?
I mean, it's a really regrettable development, and it's one that's really at odds with what people want in the state of Florida and across the nation. You know, there's been this move after the pandemic where some people are choosing to capitalize on some frustrations that people had about the U.S. response to COVID, and more specifically, some people's frustrations with COVID mandates and the sort of lack of agreement around COVID vaccine mandates, and trying to use that to expand restrictions in terms of people's abilities to get vaccinations. So by and large, the American public, including the public in Florida, are overwhelmingly in support of vaccines. They believe that they are life-saving. They believe that it is parents' duties not only to vaccinate their children for the protection of those children, but also the protection of society. Looking at those data, it is quite different when you look at who has gotten vaccinated against COVID. And some people have chosen to focus on the low uptake of COVID vaccines to say, well, the American people don't want vaccines. They don't want COVID vaccine mandates, and therefore we have to kind of upend the entire public health system. But in my view, those are two very different enterprises. And what's going to happen is that the relaxation of school-based entry mandates in Florida will cause deadly and expensive outbreaks that Floridians are going to suffer for. But it's also going to make it harder for kids to get vaccinated, because it's going to change the availability of vaccines and people's abilities to access them, particularly kids for whom, you know, the insurance and ability to pay is an issue.
I was going to ask, why is that? Is that because of changes to the state's handling of its, you know, public health, or I should say, you know, like Medicaid programs or private insurance, or how does that actually play out in the real world?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're learning is that all of these recent changes around vaccines is having and hard to fully quantify, but concerning sort of upending of the whole vaccine distribution system, including government subsidies and health insurance coverage for vaccines. It's also changing who provides vaccinations. So we're hearing about recent changes and requirements now changing the availability of vaccines. It has also meant that providers may now be worried about whether they are going to incur liability for providing vaccine, and the kind of chaos about what's allowed and what's not is changing providers' willingness to provide vaccine. So we know that about, you know, half of U.S. children receive vaccines through the Vaccines for Children's program, and there are concerns about, particularly with upcoming federal advisory committee meetings and an attention to look at the vaccination schedule, that may have consequences for what vaccines can be offered when to children. And without that prompt that school-based vaccination requirements require, we may just see fewer children protected through a variety of reasons, including some of this chaos.
Regina Rabinovich, can you speak to how this sort of change could affect the vulnerability of all kinds of people, not just school children, to infectious diseases?
Well, It really depends on immunization rates potentially waning immunity, but things like measles, highly infectious. I myself developed measles when I was 21, and it is something that those who did not respond to the vaccine or never were vaccinated remain at risk for life. The other are childhood diseases, which we have not seen. Measles was gone in the Americas. It was gone. And we had not had a case in the United States other than somebody coming in from the outside. Maybe pockets of unvaccinated children for religious reasons have remained at risk. So it is not just childhood diseases, but some of these diseases can also affect adults have no boundaries.
Jennifer Nuzzo, let's talk about COVID vaccines. Pharmacies across the country are getting the latest yearly vaccine against this disease, and yet there is a lot of confusion over who can get them. The FDA announced that their guidance is that only older adults and younger people with high-risk health conditions can get the vaccine. What do you make of that change?
Well, it's causing a tremendous amount of chaos. The reality is all of the decisions haven't been made. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, which is the group of, historically, it's been a group of independent experts who advise CDC. The director of CDC then makes a decision with the input of that group to make recommendations as to who should receive the vaccine. That deliberation hasn't happened yet for COVID vaccines. And we're anticipating that the upcoming meeting, which is in about, I think it's next week, will yield some insights. Now, there are worries, of course, because the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practice is no longer populated by people who have relevant expertise to make those decisions. So there's worries about what the deliberations of that will be. But what we do know is that it's already having an impact in terms of who's being able to access vaccines. And in fact, several months ago when the Secretary of Health and Human Services sort of tweeted an intention to change who should receive COVID vaccines and omitted from the list of who would be should be eligible to receive vaccines, pregnant women, we know that pregnant women have reported not being able to get COVID vaccines in part because of a misunderstanding of their eligibility. We also know that some providers, including pharmacy chains, have decided not to start scheduling appointments for COVID vaccination. So it's causing a lot of chaos. We're hearing things about some states making requirements as to who should be able to get it that contradicts what federal agencies has had. All of this means it's going to be harder for everyone to get vaccinated, including people who may be in the category that everyone agrees should get vaccines, people who are at high risk for severe illness, including people over the age of 65. It may be because the pharmacy that you used to get your vaccine at no longer is offering appointments or carrying it. It may be because your provider has decided not to offer it. It may be because your provider now is worried about liability exposure in terms of providing vaccines, and it's just too hard to keep track of who's eligible and who's not. So this is a very unfortunate situation because the window of time that most people have in order to protect themselves before they get COVID is quite small, and sort of any delay and confusion can really lead to a situation where people don't get vaccinated before they get infected.
You know, last week, RFK Jr. said at that Senate Finance Committee that mRNA vaccines, quote, cause serious harm, including death, particularly in young people, end quote. Jennifer Nuzzo, what do you say to that?
That's just not true. It's just not true. The secretary has been saying that before they even started vaccinated people with mRNA-based vaccines. There was a report that was published in the fall of 2020. So before COVID vaccines were being offered to people, before even healthcare workers were getting vaccinated, the anti-vax community to which the secretary belongs, organized itself, and they recognized that in their quest to sow distrust about vaccines in general and ultimately to take vaccines off the market, that by sowing distrust about these new COVID vaccines and the new technology that underpin them, that they would gain a foothold in more reasonable households. And so this is just simply not true. There is no safety signal that we have seen with the mRNA vaccine, generally speaking. There had been some earlier concerns about potential myocarditis in a very limited portion of the population. I think all the subsequent analyses that have been done don't find that those signals, that they're larger than what COVID can do to somebody, but that's just simply not true. And the reality is the secretary is making those statements without actually getting briefings from the experts in the health agencies who have the data. It's just a statement based on probably, you know, things that are being spread online.
Yeah. And I mean, you said safety signals, and I think you mentioned this, but it's worth remembering 1.2 million people did die of COVID. not the vaccines. What talk about the promise though of mRNA vaccines? Because I mean, I've heard people saying, you know, this could potentially have some breakthrough treatments for cancer somewhere down the line. How concerned are you with some of this research being defunded or, you know, possibly even prohibited, that it could, you know, set us back? What are the opportunity costs?
Yeah, there's really not a lot about the COVID-19 pandemic that you consider a bright point. I mean, as you mentioned, we lost more than 1 million American lives. I mean, that is extraordinary. It's extraordinary for everything. But as someone who kind of got my start in public health after the events of September 11th, and I reflect back on how the sudden loss of 3,000 American lives changed our country, to think that we could lose 1 million Americans and be asking ourselves, you know, did we really think it was necessary to try to prevent more death? I mean, it's just unbelievable to me. So yes, there is very little we can say that was positive about COVID-19, the pandemic. However, the scientific innovation that happened during the pandemic is truly a bright spot. mRNA based technology is really one of the most significant medical innovations of recent times. First of all, the fact that we had multiple safe and effective vaccines in a year is an extraordinary achievement. And, you know, many, many deaths were prevented from the use of those vaccines. But the ability to use that technology, perhaps to maybe one day create a vaccine against cancer, and not just, you know, any cancer, but a patient's specific cancer, is a scientific possibility that many, many, many researchers are very, very excited about. We don't know fully what all the benefits are that mRNA vaccine technologies can offer, but there's enough promise there that it is worth further investigation. And unfortunately, the Secretary of Health and Human Services just recently, without really any evidence whatsoever, just a general gripe against vaccines, canceled in a no-notice fashion $500 million of research and development projects that would have yielded important insights about how we could use this technology for the betterment of humanity. Now, they'll say they didn't cancel cancer vaccine projects, but the overall effect of this cancellation of research funding is going to have a chilling effect on the research field as a whole, coupled with all of the cuts to NIH that have been proposed and the freezing of NIH funds to universities around the country. I am deeply worried about U.S. medical innovation, and in particular, when it comes to the potential cures that mRNA vaccines may offer us.
We're losing ground to other countries, too, potentially, in these scientific developments, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Secretary of Health and Human Services said we're not going to use mRNA. In fact, we're going to invest in more traditional vaccines, such as whole virus vaccines. China was one of the first countries to develop a vaccine in response to the pandemic, and they developed a whole virus vaccine. The evidence that we have is that it didn't work as well as the mRNA vaccines that we used here. And as a result, China has been scrambling to get in on the mRNA vaccine research field. So I anticipate we will see a much larger footprint of research in, say, China. We know other countries are looking to make investments in it. It has been an important point of pride for the United States that we were really the global leaders in mRNA research, but we are absolutely ceding ground to other countries. And what that will mean is that any future innovations developed with that technology just may be out of reach for Americans. You know, there are, I think, now open questions about whether we will be able to benefit, whether our businesses will turn to more research-friendly countries, and what that will just mean for, you know, scientific research in this country and the tremendous return to the U.S. economy that investments in scientific research provides.
All right, we are going to have to take a break. Let me reintroduce our conversation. We're speaking with Jennifer Nuzzo, professor of epidemiology, director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health, and Regina Rabinovich, former head of infectious diseases for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, currently a scholar in residence at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. I should say we got some text messages from our listeners this morning. Ann in Urbana said, obviously those who want to lift the vaccine vaccine mandates don't remember or never experienced the illnesses these vaccines prevent. When I got measles at 5, I ran a fever of 105 for 4 days that pitted my permanent teeth, which hadn't come in yet, and affected my sight. Because measles is a virus, there weren't any antibiotics with which to treat them, just cold baths and aspirin. My brother-in-law got mumps while going through puberty that caused him to be sterile. 800-222-9455 to join us today. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking for the hour about public health in America and around the world. Our guests are Jennifer Nuzzo, professor of epidemiology, director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health, and Regina Rabinovich, scholar in residence at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, also former head of infectious diseases for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. Joe is calling from Urbana, Illinois. Joe, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, good afternoon. I don't even know where to start because I mean, so many of the topics touch so many things. I mean, Dr. Ladipo, I mean, I'm probably a contemporary of his parents in Lagos, Nigeria, before they came to the United States. And I am appalled because as a Nigerian, I remember standing in line to get a polio vaccine, to get the smallpox vaccine, to do those things. And I'm sure his parents were there too, getting those vaccines. And they saved their lives. And he's here in the United States telling American
this is the Florida public health person down there. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
His name's Joseph Abiodun Ladipo. That is his name. And Abiodun means he was born around Christmas. But that's a different story. But I called initially about USAID, and my sister just survived malaria living in Nigeria. She's a 69-year-old with high blood pressure and diabetes. And I'm glad that she was able to survive the malaria, but also the fact that we're cutting the funding for all these things. Just it's crazy. I mean, I came to the United States as a political science international relations major, and I'm looking at USAID was soft power. I had an uncle who worked for USAID in Nigeria, and it was soft power that worked around the country and around Africa. Yes, the United States has done some crazy things. I was going to use a different word, but USAID was soft power that actually worked and fed people. I grew up during the Biafra Civil War in Nigeria, and it worked. I saw things that helped. I don't even know what else to say, but, I mean, thank you for having this conversation. Hopefully we have a deeper conversation. And RFK is a disgrace to his name. That's all I can say. Thank you.
Joe, thank you for the call. Regina Rabinovich, I don't know if you want to respond to anything he said there.
Thank you. Well, clearly this is a huge change and reflects a huge change in what donors, the United States and other donors are doing, because they're facing climate expenses, they're facing warfare on their home front, and you know, Europe is quite worried about this. So it's part of a larger internalization of prioritization for countries at a political level and an economic level. The biological threats, resistance, the change in donors, the uncertainty that these rapid changes have created does create a shadow of opportunity. And I want to emphasize that these countries are not without resources, they're not without powers. It is an opportunity for country-led agendas. It's an opportunity to break silos and drive integration and better collaboration within countries. And I think one example in the midst of COVID is I held a meeting in Panama of leaders from Peru, Bolivia, and Paraguay who had been working in COVID. But we're also dealing with dengue and chikungunya, two other infectious diseases, big epidemics. And those three countries that share borders had never met with each other to strategize. So there are ways of building up domestic financing, better collaborations, better integration of efforts. And this is all going to be tested very rapidly, because the countries aren't just sitting there saying, woe is me. They're trying to respond as best as they can and having to make some very tough decisions. I really respect the work that they are doing.
We got a text message from a listener with a sort of a news you can use kind of question. Sonia asks, says, I'm a senior. I was vaccinated as a child. I got measles as a child. Am I still safe from getting measles now if I come in contact with someone with the measles virus? Dr. Rabinovich, can you take that on?
I believe so. The problem with the measles vaccine, it's a great vaccine, and it protects with one dose 95% of people, but the other 5% need a second dose somewhere older, when they're older. And so we built in that second dose of vaccine in the immunization program. By getting actual measles, she did not respond to her first dose, but got immunized by having wild type disease and did well with it, which is wonderful. So she is protected. This is my understanding.
Okay. Thank you for that. Jennifer Nuzzo, let me ask you, we're seeing different states as the CDC is sort of pulling back from some of its recommendations. You know, the University of Minnesota epidemiologist Michael Osterholm is working with colleagues to offer accurate and up-to-date data to help states with their fall vaccine recommendations. We've seen California, Oregon, and Washington forming a West Coast Health Alliance. What do you make of all these developments?
I mean, it is a necessary development given the upheaval and the real attempt to kind of the departure from evidence-based approaches and sort of a nationally coordinated approach, but it's not a sufficient response. And here's why. You know, a state may decide it is still important for us to protect a group of people who are at high risk for severe illness, infants and toddlers. The American Academy of Pediatrics has come out and said that the infants and toddlers very much should still continue to be vaccinated against COVID. There's been a disagreement with FDA and HHS on that front. So a state may be able to say that. The challenge is the vaccine distribution system is not a state-based enterprise. It's not even a regional-based enterprise. The decision of how much vaccine is made and where it goes is something that has to be nationally coordinated. It's also challenging because, you know, again, clinicians now are worried about whether providing vaccinations will open them up to, you know, even frivolous lawsuits. And so it makes it harder for people to be vaccinated. So while I think it is important for states to take a look at how best to protect their population, and I am anticipating that they're going to increasingly have to do that as there has been an attempt to dismantle the usual evidence-based and transparent process by which vaccine policy has been made and set at the national level. It is going to be very hard for people living even in states that want to be more, you know, aggressive in terms of being able to offer vaccines to their populace if manufacturers and distributors and including, you know, pharmacy chains are unable to kind of keep up with this patchwork approach that we've created across the country.
I got to say, from on a personal note, when I read some of these stories about some of these changes that are happening, I can't wrap my mind around it. And, you know, I look at NBC News had a poll in the past few days. 78% of the respondents said they are strongly or at least somewhat supportive of the use of vaccines. I mean, even President Trump had a quote about this Florida decision, who said, you have vaccines that work. They just pure and simple work. They're not controversial at all. And I think those vaccines should be used. Jennifer Nuzzo, what do you make of just the fact that there's this seemingly pretty small contingent of people in public health who are so vocally anti-vaccine?
I mean, it's just mind-boggling. It's true. When you look at the polling, and poll after poll after poll shows that the majority of Americans across all political parties support vaccines, want vaccines, want more medical research, not less. They believe that vaccinating children with, and we're talking about routine immunizations here, is the obligation of parents not only to protect those children, but to protect broader society. That is what the polling shows. And that's You know, there was reporting last week that a Republican memo was circulating saying that fact, and that is possibly why you heard some change in tone with some of the Republican senators at the recent hearing at which the Secretary of Health and Human Services testified. People, by and large, want vaccines. Now, where there is some daylight, I would say, is on when it comes to COVID vaccinations. And I would say it's not even COVID vaccinations. I think where there is probably the strongest discontent was around mandates around COVID vaccines. It's the first time in modern history that we mandated across the country vaccines for adults. So, and it was under extraordinary circumstances. And so you can imagine that not everybody was happy with that approach. And that residual discontent is being used as an excuse to erode protections broadly, including protections that the public by and large wants. And so these moves are very much at odds with what the public wants. The public wants to maintain access and norms around routine immunizations. COVID vaccines have been a challenging situation, not even because people don't trust the vaccine. That's the other narrative that we're hearing, is that, well, people don't trust the vaccine. The polling on the COVID vaccine shows less support than routine immunizations, the things you give your kids when they're babies and toddlers. But that support is still actually quite high. But people have been, not getting the COVID boosters. And that may have less to do with the vaccine and more due to the fact that they sometimes get offered at the wrong time of year. So if you take last year, as an example, we had a fairly large wave of COVID in the summer. And then by the time the COVID boosters came available in September and in the fall, a lot of people had already had COVID. And so they'd actually didn't need to get vaccinated. And so that low uptake in the fall may not be due to distrust. It may just be due to the fact that we haven't figured out the best way to optimize the impact of boosters, including when to offer it and how best to promote it.
That exact thing happened in my own family last year. So one of us got COVID late in the year and therefore was kind of told not to get the booster for a time. And beyond that, couldn't get one for my youngest kid because just there were none in our region available, despite our many attempts. Look, we only have a couple of minutes left. I do try to end these darker conversations on a constructive note if we can. Jennifer Nuzzo, what is something people can do to both take care of their own health and, you know, advocate for the kind of public health they want to see in this country?
Yeah, so I think the important thing is that for people to remember that they have a voice and to make sure that their elected officials understand what their views are. If there's anything that can come out of this, kind of chaos, is that we have been taking for granted the extraordinary benefits that vaccines offer. And now we are having a conversation about what the potential loss of access to those vaccines might entail. And as a result, creating even a greater constituency to, fight for the continued access to them. So making sure that people can voice to their elected officials that vaccines are important, they want to maintain access to them, and that they don't find this attempt to kind of dismantle the CDC and dismantle the usual transparent and evidence-based approaches to federal vaccination policy, that's acceptable. We have to absolutely fight that. And if there's any upside, is that I think a lot more people are even thinking about the issue and willing to have conversations to preserve their access to these life-saving tools.
Regina Rabinovich, just about a minute left, and I'm going to have to hold you to that. So same question to you, though. What advice would you have for people to both take care of themselves and sort of advocate for what they want?
I think we all want to be healthy. And that's a result of both prevention with vaccines and whatever that the things that you're at risk for present to you, but also with therapies. And the United States has been a leader in biomedical research. So it's not only about promoting and ensuring access to the products that we enjoy right now, but also building for the future the funding at NIH for continued investment and partnership with industry and small biotechs that are having these marvelous ideas and breakthroughs, so that access and progress continues in health. I think we all share wanting better health. We may define it differently.
Dr. Regina Rabinovich, former head of infectious diseases for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and a scholar at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and Jennifer Nuzzo, professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health. Thank you both so much for being with us today and sharing your knowledge with us here on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking a little bit about a new discovery that teaches us a little bit more about the ancient tropical history of Illinois. It's coming up tomorrow here on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Kahn, technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.